Chapter 5. Valperga, The Last Man, The Fortunes of Perkin Warbeck, and The New Frankenstein, 1821 to 1831. Mary Shelley's middle novels, Valperga, The Last Man, and The Fortunes of Perkin Warbeck, are the first that she published under her own name. Although earlier female authors, such as Clara Reeve, Susanna Dobson, Anne Radcliffe, and Elizabeth Rowe, had attained acclaim for their work, ranging from translations and scholarly work to Gothic novels and historical fiction, it was still difficult for a woman author to make her way in what was essentially a man's world. The publication of work under her own name was always a significant step for any woman author, one that Jane Austen, for example, never took. And this made Mary Shelley's acknowledgement of her role as author particularly courageous, as Valperga, The Last Man, and The Fortunes of Perkin Warbeck are more explicitly political than her earlier works, with the exception of 6 Weeks. Developing some of the themes that she first articulated in 6 Weeks, she depicts the evils of war and tyranny in all 3 novels, at the same time that she emphasizes the stumbling blocks that impede social and political reform. However, the dislocations in time and place in all 3 works allowed Mary Shelley to veil her critiques. Both Valperga and Perkin Warbeck are set in the past, enabling her to make her political points indirectly. She could describe the suffering caused by historical tyrants and long-ago wars, rather than detailing the problems caused by present-day rulers or contemporary conflicts. The Last Man also offers trenchant criticisms of 19th-century politics and social systems, but as a dystopian vision of a catastrophic future. For today's reader, Mary Shelley's political leanings are easily discernible. In the historical novels, the central female characters, Euthanasia and Catherine, articulate the Wollstonecraftian principles of freedom and community. Although they fail to achieve their goals, their advocacy is clearly meant to be admirable. In The Last Man, the protagonist, Lionel, supports and extends these ideas. One of the few male characters in Mary Shelley's fiction who is capable of growth and change, Lionel endures tremendous suffering, which gives him the wisdom he was lacking in his youth. Despite the overt political and ideological themes in all 3 of these books, most contemporary readers did not comment on them. Women writers were not, by convention, supposed to venture into the realm of politics, and so Mary Shelley's work was regularly misunderstood by reviewers. Critics characterized the historical novels Valperga and Warbeck as romances, and her apocalyptic vision of the future in The Last Man as diseased and perverted, entirely overlooking her commitment to the radical themes of her mother. Valperga, 1823. Mary Shelley's first historical novel, Valperga, took more than 2 years to write. Looking back, she said the idea came to her when she was still living in England, but she did not start writing the book until she had finished Matilda in 1819 and had given birth to her 4th child, Percy Florence, in November of that same year. The new child's arrival could not, of course, take away from the grief of losing Clara or Wilmouse, but she relished having a child to nurture. Writing to a friend that the 5 months of being childless after Will's death had been one of the most wrenching times in her life. But though the new baby gave her a glimmer of hope, Valperga was still fueled by the loss of her children and her increasing outrage over the repressive politics in England. That August, in what has become known as the Peterloo Massacre, cavalry charged into a crowd of around 60,000 people in Manchester who had gathered peacefully to demand greater representation in Parliament. The people's protests were well warranted. Poor economic conditions had created deep distress amongst the working classes. According to one contemporary observer in Manchester, nothing but ruin and starvation stare one in the face. In Percy's sonnet, England in 1819, the people are starved and stabbed in the untilled field. The king is old, mad, blind, despised. To Mary Shelley, of particular importance, was the fact that of the 654 recorded casualties at Peterloo, at least 168 were women. Observers suggested that they were targeted by the soldiers, as they were easy to distinguish, dressed in distinctive white of the reform movement. This violence amplified Mary Shelley's anger, and she filled her new book with the principles of reform, once again using a historical setting to critique the problems she saw in her own time. In Naples, before William died, she had begun to read medieval history as a way of coping with the loss of Clara. After she and Percy left Naples, she continued to delve into the past, researching and visiting historical sites. As part of her research, she came across the character of Prince Castruccio Castracani in a biography by Machiavelli. Machiavelli praises Castruccio for his ruthlessness as the leader of the Ghibellines in the civil war with the Guelphs in 14th century Italy. But to Mary Shelley, who had never forgotten the devastated countryside in France, Castruccio seemed dangerous, the forerunner of a leader like Napoleon, charismatic but destructive, inspirational but tyrannical. She decided to write a novel based on his life, emphasizing the suffering he caused, condemning precisely what Machiavelli had admired, his strength as war commander and his bloodthirsty pursuit of power. She began by tracing Castruccio's descent from innocent boy to cruel tyrant. Like the creature in Frankenstein, he does not start life as a murderous demon. Cruel treatment shapes him into a ruthless killer. Driven from his home by his family's enemies, he swears to avenge his loss. Old friends offer him refuge in Valperga, their castle, even though he is a Ghibellina and they are Guelphs. Here he is treated kindly by the Count and falls in love with the Count's daughter, Euthanasia, a fictional character. A rational, self-aware, and classically educated young woman, Euthanasia's rigorous study of the Greeks and Romans has made her a proponent of natural liberties and republican government. Although it is highly unlikely that such a woman would have existed in 14th century Tuscany, to Mary Shelley, historical accuracy was far less important than creating a female counterforce to Castruccio. She needed Euthanasia to reveal the impact of male ambition, war, and oppressive acts of the state on the lives of women as well as ordinary citizens. Furthermore, she subscribed to romantic ideals about history writing, that readers needed the historical record to be enlivened by the imagination, or they would find the past dry and lifeless. Castruccio, inflamed with passion, pursues Euthanasia, and she agrees to marry him, a hopeful moment in the narrative. Union between Castruccio and Euthanasia offers an opportunity for peace between the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. If they marry, they could unite the warring factions and harmony could rule the land. But Castruccio refuses to lay down his arms, impelled by his urge to conquer the land, including Euthanasia's Florence. And so Euthanasia breaks off their engagement, taking a stand for the liberty of her people. No matter how much she loves Castruccio, freedom is more important, she declares, refusing to let him dominate her or her people. With this heroic stance, Euthanasia becomes a champion of peace and liberty, as well as the leader of the forces who try to stop the prince. Ultimately, she fails, as Castruccio quickly subdues the Guelph strongholds, burning down Euthanasia's home, Valperga. After her defeat, Castruccio exiles Euthanasia to Sicily. During the voyage, her ship sinks and she drowns. Euthanasia's death at the end of the novel belies her strength as a character and seems, at first, a pessimistic ending. But even though she loses the struggle with Castruccio, Euthanasia offers a significant alternative to the ambitions of the warlord. An active and inspirational leader, she challenges his power, a challenge that is absent in Frankenstein, where no one except the creature can do battle with Victor. Accordingly, the narrator's claim that Earth felt no change when she died and men forgot her is undercut by the novel itself, as far from being forgotten when she dies, Euthanasia, fictional creature though she is, lives on in the pages of Valperga. The narrative becomes a restoration, even a resurrection of a heroic woman's life. In returning Euthanasia's story to history, Mary Shelley undermines the glorification of war and subverts Machiavelli's version of Castruccio as a hero, presenting Castruccio's wars of conquest as villainous acts of destruction. As Euthanasia laments, the people are driven from their homes, often a poor child lost or haplessly wounded, whose every drop of blood is more worth than the power of the Caesars. If Castruccio symbolizes the dangerous effects of male ambition and is blinded by his obsessive need to avenge the miseries of his childhood, Euthanasia stands for enlightened reform, peace, union, harmony, and reason, the virtues which Wollstonecraft had advocated, and which all of the male characters in Mary Shelley's fiction had hitherto resisted or undercut. Euthanasia is forward-thinking and dreams of a united Italy, just as Mary Shelley and her fellow reformers dreamed of a united Europe in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars. Although her hopes that the national leaders at the Congress of Vienna would embrace liberal reforms were dashed, the dream of a unified Europe, predicated on natural rights, would continue to inspire Mary Shelley for the rest of her career. Euthanasia's unusual name points to Mary Shelley's political ideals. Angela Wright explains that euthanasia means good death or noble death, and is probably derived from Mary Shelley's reading of Hume's essays, Moral and Political, in which Hume writes that absolute monarchy is the easiest death, the true euthanasia of the British Constitution. By creating the character of euthanasia, Mary Shelley could write a story where the tyrant has a worthy opponent, a strong woman who leads the fight against injustice. But euthanasia's death is also essential to the story, as Mary Shelley wanted to demonstrate that when men are guided by ambition, not love, and by fame, not family, then not only do women and children pay the price, but so does all of humanity. Euthanasia's many virtues cannot triumph over Castruccio's lust for power, but her memory can live on as an inspiration for freedom fighters everywhere. Midway through the novel, Mary Shelley introduces a second female character, Beatrice, whose tragic fate reinforces the idea that war and conquest cause suffering. Beatrice, the daughter of Wilhelmina, a historical figure from the 12th century, whose followers saw her as the Holy Ghost, the savior of the female sex, is another of Mary Shelley's inventions. Like Wilhelmina, she is viewed as a savior by her followers, but she is persecuted by the Inquisition. She escapes with the help of sympathetic priests, only to fall in love with Castruccio. Unlike euthanasia, she does not have the benefit of a rational education, and as a result, is not independent enough to withstand his passion. Having been raised in the superstitions of the church, she is at the mercy of her feelings and dreams. Unable to recognize Castruccio's capacity for cruelty, she surrenders to him completely, losing her sense of self. When he casts her off, she is captured by a villainous priest who imprisons her and rapes her. The virtuous Euthanasia rescues Beatrice from her sufferings, even though she knows that Beatrice is in love with Castruccio. In a traditional romance, they would have been pitted against each other as opponents. But in Mary Shelley's novel, their friendship triumphs over their feelings for Castruccio. Indeed, that their love stories with Castruccio fail is one of the most significant points of the novel. As a character, Castruccio is too self-enclosed and too much of a tyrant to allow either woman to sway him from his bloody course. Euthanasia's appeal to reason and peace cannot restrain him, and neither can Beatrice's beauty and mysticism. Drawn together by their sufferings and the truths they have come to understand, both women are protective of each other. Although Beatrice is not as strong as Euthanasia and cannot rescue her from Castruccio, she can take care of her in other ways. Accordingly, as Angela Wright points out, when Euthanasia asks Beatrice to tell her about the tortures she has endured, Beatrice gives her an edited version to spare Euthanasia pain. Like Matilda, she refuses to obsess over the abuse she has experienced, exerting control over her narrative and differentiating herself from Victor Frankenstein and Walton, who recite the terrors they have experienced in gruesome detail, knowing full well that they will induce blood-curdling horror in their listeners. Euthanasia records Beatrice's tale as well as her own, stories that would otherwise go untold. Like her creator, and like Matilda, Euthanasia is a writer, as her private chronicles are the purported origins of Valperga. Through the miracle of fiction, Mary Shelley has remembered her, keeping alive not only Euthanasia's particular story, but the story of Beatrice, the story of two women who support one another in the midst of oppression. With the creation of these two female characters and the allusion to Wilhelmina, Mary Shelley invokes her mother's ideals, setting them against the militaristic values of Machiavelli and his successors. Although Beatrice is represented as a weaker character, she and her mother are still important figures, as they demonstrate Mary Shelley's view that the church's patriarchal system abused women and deprived them of power. Having been trained to devote herself to her mystical dreams and obey the dictates of her overly active imagination, Beatrice is not capable of Euthanasia's reasoned approach to life, but she is still able to forge a bond with Euthanasia, a far stronger alliance than either woman can have with the great warlord. Ultimately, by making Euthanasia and Beatrice central characters in the novel, Mary Shelley was able to augment, comment on, and cast doubt on the historical record. Fiction was the only way to include the perspectives of women, whose voices were traditionally absent from chronicles and archives. When Valperga was published, Mary Shelley, expected to be attacked for her radical politics, embedded as they were in the women's viewpoints, but the reviewers missed the ideas that inspired the novel. The novel's critique of tyranny, its advocacy for reform, its celebration of female friendship and education, and its depiction of Euthanasia as a fearless leader who defies the authoritarian desires of a warlord. Instead, they commented on Euthanasia as a feminine ideal of virtue and criticized the author for having Euthanasia reject Castruccio. As a reviewer in the Literary Gazette declared, "It scarcely seems in a woman's nature for patriotism to be a stronger feeling than love." Nor did they praise Mary Shelley's innovations, how she had overturned the conventions of the historical romance by creating two heroines who forge an alliance against the hero, who is, in fact, a villain. But in fact, in Castruccio, Mary Shelley had created another monstrous character, this time handsome in appearance, but monstrous all the same, a domineering male figure who killed children, as the creature did in Frankenstein. And she had also created a heroine, a female adversary, who may not have been able to prevent her opponent's military victories, but who could represent another way, another course to history. Through fiction, Mary Shelley was able to offer a critique of the historical account, as well as a critique of male heroism. Mary Shelley had come far from Frankenstein. Though Euthanasia cannot stop Castruccio's aggression, Mary Shelley emphasizes her importance in the narrative, setting Castruccio's politics of war against Euthanasia's politics of reason, his politics of violence against her politics of peace. Even the ending, which, as the scholar Betty T. Bennett argues, is open and cyclical rather than conclusive, suggests that history moves in waves and that no act of protest is for naught. Accordingly, though Castruccio triumphs over Euthanasia in this particular moment of history, Mary Shelley emphasizes that his victory is temporary. He too dies, and his kingdom falls, opening the door for another wave of resistance, another chance at reform, another euthanasia. who might succeed. Ultimately, Valperga represents a remarkable departure from Mary Shelley's first two novels. In the dystopian world of Frankenstein, the strongest female character, M.W.S., is offstage, and the other women, with the exception of Safi, are murdered. Even the female creature, who could have had a positive influence on the creature, is destroyed by Victor. In Matilda, the heroine is capable of resisting her father, but her life is both limited and defined by him. Not until Valperga did Mary envision a female character who could stand up to a tyrant. Euthanasia may lose her battle with Castruccio, but Castruccio's tyranny and cruelty earns him the condemnation of history, while Euthanasia's courage, integrity, and commitment to peace and liberty serve as inspiration. Furthermore, Valperga is one of the first novels to demonstrate the suffering caused by Machiavelli's political philosophy. Others had condemned Machiavelli's means-to-an-end policies, but Mary Shelley explored their real-life consequences, the cruelties of this kind of leadership. Castruccio betrays those he loves to consolidate his empire. He is treacherous, killing opponents without mercy. Like Victor Frankenstein, he has boundless ambition, pursuing honor, fame, dominion, despite his beloved's protests. In Euthanasia, on the other hand, Mary Shelley had created a standard-bearer for freedom, a woman who could show protesters how to persevere in the face of tyranny, who refused marriage to fight for freedom. An embodiment of Wollstonecraft's principles, Euthanasia is an emblem of the possibilities of radical reform. As Mary Shelley put the finishing touches to Valperga, news arrived that served to confirm her bleak outlook on the world. The newly crowned English king, George IV, whom she and other liberals despised as an authoritarian fool, had driven his wife, Queen Caroline, out of England simply because he disliked her. If the queen, who Mary Shelley admired for being the symbolic leader of the liberal movement in England, could be sent into exile on the whim of her husband, it was further evidence of how all women, even queens, were at the mercy of men, and how liberty was the victim of tyranny. The world needed her novel, she believed. She needed to continue the fight that her mother began in A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, not just for the rights of woman, but for the rights of all people. It was her duty to be a kind of literary euthanasia, and use her writing to advance the causes of reform, education, peace, and independence. Percy's death. But Mary Shelley's life was about to undergo a dramatic change. In 1822, after she had sent the manuscript of Valperga to England for publication, tragedy struck again. This time, it would overturn everything, setting her on a path she could never have envisioned. After the deaths of Clara and Wilmouse, Mary Shelley and Percy had become increasingly estranged. When Percy Florence was born, Mary Shelley had retreated almost entirely into the writing of Valperga, while Percy involved himself in his own projects and, most likely, had affairs with other women. They were still each other's first readers for their work, but Mary Shelley felt that Percy did not mourn their children deep enough. Percy believed that she was too hard on him and complained to his friends that she was cold and critical. The tension between them slowly mounted until it came to a sudden end on 8 July, 1822. That summer, Mary Shelley, Claire, and Percy had retreated from the heat of Pisa, where they had been living, to the Bay of Spezia, with their friends Jane and Edward Williams. Byron, too, had found a house further down the coast. Pregnant for the fifth time, Mary Shelley wrote to her friend, Maria Gisborne. "My nerves were wound up to the utmost irritation. No words can tell you how I hated our house and the country about it." This house, the Casa Mani, was a big wedge-shaped villa with dirty white walls, isolated from the tiny town by a stony beach and steep hill. Figure 7. Originally a boathouse, the Casa Mani opened to the sea, Sometimes the water washed over the small stone wall, flooding the ground floor, thrilling Percy and horrifying Mary Shelley. There was no escaping the pounding of the surf. It was impossible to walk to town in the heat, especially if one was tired and pregnant. But everything that Mary Shelley loathed, Percy loved: the isolation, the bleak coastal scenery, the loneliness of the location. He could not swim, but was passionate about sailing and had hired a new friend, Edward Trelawney, who had retired from the Navy to oversee the building of a new boat. When the boat was delivered to the Casamani, Percy was as delighted as a small child. He christened her the Ariel and spent most of his time tinkering with the rigging, sailing, or leaning against the mast, jotting down ideas for poems in his notebook. But his spirits sank when Byron came sailing into the bay, as Byron's ship was bigger and faster. Always competitive with Byron, he devised a plan to lengthen the masts of his boat. More experienced sailors would have known that the Ariel did not have a deep enough keel to handle bigger sails, but Percy only cared about making his boat swifter than Byron's. Mary Shelley watched these proceedings with foreboding, but she was feeling increasingly ill, and on 16 June woke up bleeding. Percy came to the rescue, plunging her into an ice bath and saving her life, but she lost the child. Another loss, another sorrow to add to the others. For days, she was too weak to get up. She begged Percy to stay with her, but he was restless and insisted on sailing across the Gulf to visit Byron, ostensibly to discuss their new literary journal, The Liberal, which Percy had started with Byron and other friends, but also to show off the improvements to his new boat. Mary Shelley and Jane Williams watched their husband set sail on 1 July. Later, Mary Shelley wrote that she could hardly endure that he had left and cried bitterly when he went away. Percy promised they would sail back in a week. But 8 July came and went, and the men did not return. As the days passed, it became clear that something had happened. At last, on 19 July, news came that the bodies of Percy, Edward Williams, and an 18-year-old boy whom they had hired as an extra hand had washed up on shore. Apparently, a storm had blown up on the 8th when the sailors were about 10 miles out to sea, at least 4 hours away from the protected waters near Casamani. Although no one blamed him for the ship's poor design, Trelawney seems to have felt guilty, as he created a false story, saying that pirates had attacked Percy and Edward Williams. But this story has never been substantiated and seems to have stemmed from Trelawney's desire to evade responsibility, as one of the reasons the ship went down was its general unseaworthiness. Too heartbroken to oversee the details of the burial, Mary Shelley allowed Trelawney to organize a theatrical send-off. He arranged a funeral pyre for both men, burning Edward Williams on 15 August and Percy on 16 August. Mary Shelley could not bear to witness this event, evidence to Trelawney that she was not worthy of Percy's love. But even Byron could not bear to watch, leaving Trelawney alone at the fire, convincing him that though he had just met Percy the preceding year, he was actually Percy's truest friend. As Percy's corpse fell open, Trelawney later recalled, the heart was laid bare. He snatched it from the flames and gave it to Percy's friend, Leigh Hunt, as he thought that Mary Shelley did not seem grief-stricken enough to warrant having the heart. But Mary Shelley's way of coping with sorrow had always been to retreat into herself, appearing unmoved to those who did not know her well. In her journal, she addressed the accusations of those who accused her of being unfeeling. A cold heart. Have I a cold heart? God knows. At least the tears are hot. Fortunately, Jane Williams intervened, asking Hunt to give the heart to Mary Shelley, and he agreed. However, this battle was a sign of what was to come, as Trelawney would go on to publish his criticisms of Mary Shelley in his memoir. The two sparred over the publication of Percy's poetry and other issues, none of which would matter to history if Trelawney's negative opinions had not harmed Mary Shelley's reputation after she died. Unaware of Trelawney's machinations, Mary Shelley was devastated and guilt-ridden. She had been cold to Percy in the weeks before his death, and angry. Now she could not forgive herself. "All that might have been bright in my life is now despoiled," she wrote to her friend, Maria Gisborne, on 15 August. At the age of 24, Mary Shelley was a widow. She had one surviving little boy. Heartbroken, she decided to compensate for her treatment of Percy by dedicating her life to publishing his work and telling his life story. But pragmatic concerns interrupted her plans. After Percy's death, his allowance from his father, Sir Timothy, came to an abrupt halt. Before she could write his biography and publish his poems, she needed an income, and so she sought to augment her finances, publishing A Tale of the Passions and two biographical essays in The Liberal. Valperga was published in 1823, along with another edition of Frankenstein. But these publications did not bring in much money, and so, with reluctance, she wrote to Sir Timothy, asking for assistance. This was a difficult letter to write, as she knew that Sir Timothy hated her. He had been her implacable enemy ever since she ran away with Percy, even going to court in an attempt to invalidate their marriage. She hoped that the thought of his grandson would soften his heart, but Sir Timothy refused to help her unless she returned to England and handed her son over to the Shelley family. She refused to surrender Percy Florence, but she did return to London, where Sir Timothy remained adamant. He would provide no financial support unless he had the boy. But Mary Shelley, who had already lost three children and had just completed a novel imagining a female character's brave resistance to male tyranny, was, like euthanasia, a worthy opponent and hired an excellent lawyer. In November 1823, she won a small allowance from the Shelley estate, but in exchange, she had to agree not to publish any of Percy's works or write anything about him. If she disregarded these rules, she would be cut off without a penny. Furthermore, if Sir Timothy discovered that she was in debt and could not support herself and her son, then he would take her child into custody, Mary Shelley's greatest fear. Sir Timothy's allowance was helpful, but it was not enough to free Mary Shelley from the need to earn money, and she realized that she would have to stay in England to be close to the publishing world. Other women writers, including her mother, had earned enough money to support themselves, but she knew it would be an uphill battle. She wrote in her journal that she felt unprotected and even attacked, as women were not supposed to live independently in conservative English society. She missed her old life, ensconced in the world of Percy, Byron, and other friends who shared the same liberal values. But she knew she had to work in order to survive, and began turning out stories and articles with remarkable efficiency. Her father, whom Percy had supported for years, made it clear that he expected her to continue to assist him. So she wrote for outlets that paid well, giving Godwin as much of her earnings as she could afford. The irony of Godwin's insistence that his daughter, a single mother, support him, a long-established novelist and political philosopher, was entirely lost on him and on her. To Godwin, his own writing was of such monumental importance that nothing should stand in its way, particularly money. Mary Shelley, who had been taught to revere him, agreed. For the good of the world, her father's writing had to be encouraged, fostered, and supported. Even though she struggled to make enough to support herself and her family, her reputation as a writer was growing. While she was abroad, Frankenstein had been adapted for the stage and became popular with theatergoers. When she attended a production at the Lyceum Theater, protesters marched outside, bearing placards condemning the play. but they could not stop the crowds from filing into the theater. Proud that so many had come to see her story staged, Mary Shelley wrote to a friend that she had become famous. The irony is that she earned nothing from this production, nor from any of the others based on her book. In 19th-century England, playwrights were allowed to borrow from novels without crediting the author. They were also under no obligation to be faithful to the original story. Stage versions of Frankenstein tended to simplify the plot, making Mary Shelley's multifaceted creature a pure villain, rather than the complex mix of abandoned child and vengeful murderer she had created. Another odd development was that, over time, Mary Shelley's hubristic Victor Frankenstein almost entirely disappeared from public awareness. By as early as the 1840s, the word Frankenstein had become synonymous with the monster, and Mary Shelley's name became associated with that of a murderous fiend. At length, after establishing herself as a reliable writer for various monthlies, Mary Shelley decided to defy Sir Timothy's directive and produce a volume of Percy's work anonymously. She approached this project with eagerness, though it was far more complicated than it initially seemed. Percy had never been a tidy person, and his papers were in disarray. He had written on scraps of paper and the backs of envelopes. Many poems had been composed on different sheets of paper, making it difficult to tell where new poems began and old ones ended. Those poems that were written on one piece of paper were obscured by doodles of trees and sailboats. For Mary Shelley, going through Percy's papers was a bittersweet process. It gave her the sense that they were still in communication, but it also brought home his absence. Miserable though she was, she made the additions and deletions he seemed to indicate, choosing final versions and piecing together lines written in different locations. Fortunately, for the most part, she was working with material she had seen before. She and Percy had talked about most of the drafts, collaborators to the end. But there were also poems that Mary saw for the first time. Many of these lamented her absence from his life and his loneliness, or praised other women at her expense. As difficult as these were to read, Mary Shelley wanted the public to see his best work, and, with admirable selflessness, included these poems as well. She spent 6 months working on his papers, creating one of her most significant and most unsung accomplishments, a coherent collection of Shelley's work, a volume that would never have existed without her efforts. She wrote an anonymous preface, praising Percy as an ethereal spirit and an artist. Although she was clear that he had fearless enthusiasm for the moral and physical state of mankind, and that this was why he was pursued by hatred in his lifetime, she left out all direct mention of his notorious radicalism, his atheism, and his calls for political reform. In part, this was to make his work more appealing to the public, but it was also an effort to appease Sir Timothy. In June 1824, she published 500 copies of Posthumous Poems. The book sold briskly until Sir Timothy heard about it. He could not prove it, but he knew who was behind its publication and forced the publisher to recall all the unsold copies. However, he was too late to stop Mary Shelley's vision of Percy from reaching the public. The book was widely shared among friends, and Percy's reputation as a poet began to grow, as did the new version of the poet, Percy, the gentle soul, too good for this harsh world.